Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning, and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
And we're back with hour number two of Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette Morgan. Glad to be with Dr. Samira Umat today and Dr. Jerry Mixon and you on this May the 4th be with you day. Star Wars Day to some. Big Star Wars fan. May the 4th. Okay, we are headed to Marysville. Lisa is on the line. Hi there, Lisa. May the 4th be with you.
Thank you. You guys too. Okay, so I have a surgery coming up. I had called in, I don't know, a few months ago, but anyway, and said I have. That part doesn't matter. Anyway, I have Mohs surgery to take some basal cell cancer off of my face. It's right underneath my eye.
Oh yes,
and
yes.
It ended up on the eyelid.
And we got the ophthalmologist to chat about it.
Yes. He was there that day, Dr. Gilbert. Anyway, it is cancer, and so my surgery is scheduled in a couple weeks, and then a couple days later, I'm supposed to have the reconstructive surgery.
Okay.
The one that's the Mohs surgery, I'm fine with. All he's going to do is give me a local anesthetic, and you stay awake, no sedatives. I'm happy with that. But the oculoplastic surgeon wants me to have conscious sedation. I don't really want to, but he wants me to have it and go to this ambulatory surgery center to get the reconstructive surgery. So then I started looking things up, and I have certain conditions that when I looked up, okay, so I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, but benzodiazepines are the type of class of drugs like Valiums and Midazolam, Lorazepam, and things like that.
Yeah.
So I looked all that up, and they're the benzodiazepines. It had some things that said if a patient has certain conditions, it's contraindicated or it could cause issues. A lot of what I read scared me, and it said stuff like if you take those kind of sedatives, it said respiratory depression, hypoxemia, airway obstruction, apnea, sinus tachycardia, palpitations, heart rate changing, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so then I thought to myself, especially they seem to stress respiratory depression, that many people have issues with that, as well as airway obstruction and hypoxemia. So I already have, just as a normal, I kind of have chronic condition of shortness of breath and breathing issues. It's just not like major. I live okay with it in a sense, but it's always there where I feel like, why do I always have shortness of breath and breathing issues? Mm-hmm. I also probably have sleep apnea, although that's not been diagnosed. I just think I do because I wake up so often during the night. So I think I have it. Occasionally I have heart palpitations and a fast heart rate. But and the last one that also concerned me especially was I have taken the supplement GABA before, G-A-B-A, and I did that because I was told it can help you with your sleep, calm you, help with your sleep and all. The one time I took it, it had a terribly negative effect on me. And I told my doctor about it later, and she said, yeah, that was like an opposite effect. It made me have anxiety and sort of nightmares in the night in a way, and I kind of woke up with a panicky feeling, which I never get like that. When I wake up during the night, it's not like that, but the GABA did that, and I never took it since then. Well, but then the benzodiazepine. Thank you, I can't say it right. Yes, but I read that there is some sort of a GABA connection to it, like what it's doing in your brain to sedate you has some connection to GABA. I don't quite get it, but it made me think, gee, this doctor is going to put me on the table, think she's going to lie very still, and I'm going to do a great surgery because she's going to have conscious sedation. And I'm worried it's going to actually either kind of freak me out being on it, or I'm going to end up having respiratory depression. And then also, I just want to say, I read stuff that said anyone who has sleep apnea, you should beware of giving them sedatives of any kind. Now, I know there's different ones besides the benzodiazepine. There's like
let me see if I can put your mind at rest here a little bit, though, okay?
Yeah.
You're obviously very concerned. Mm-hmm. So let's cut to the chase. Should you or should you not have a conscious sedation? The nice thing is you have to remember the word conscious. Mm-hmm. They're not going to put you to sleep. They're not going to give you enough that you're going to drowse out and lose consciousness. The doctor wants you to be awake and able to cooperate. If he tells you to blink, he wants you to be able to blink. He wants you to be able to know what's going on. And so the doses that they're using are very short-acting medications that we can reverse, mm-hmm. actually, with a simple shot. They often, when they do use these drugs, will start an IV, or at least put just a little catheter into a blood vessel, so that if you should get too sleepy, if you should have any adverse reaction, they can reverse this drug in a matter of seconds. Mm. Okay, so we actually are using medications that are not at high enough doses to knock you out. They just make you relax, chill, mellow out a bit, so that then they can use tiny amounts of local anesthetic and still do the job. The reason they don't want to use too much local anesthetic here is that when you inject local anesthetic into the tissues swell because you have now a foreign material you've injected into the tissue. Mm. Around your eye, they're trying to do a very precise, very beautiful closure. They want to close this wound with no stress, no distortion of the tissues. They want to give you an eye that looks so good, you'll never know you had the cancer removed. Okay? But to do that, they need to actually see what the real contours of the tissues are without artificial distortion by putting a lot of local anesthetic in it. So the purpose here is to make you relax. That's all. It's not going to put you to sleep. You're not going to have sleep apnea issues. You're not going to have them wake you up.
No respiratory depression.
No respiratory depression. You'll be breathing fine. You'll be, as alert as they want you to be. Mm. This is a very, very mild, you don't even really call it anesthesia. It's sedation. Yeah. It just relaxes you. That's all. So. Yeah.
And is it oral? Now, I also don't love, I kind of get a little freaked out at IVs. And at one point, I had asked the surgery coordinator, is there a way, if I have to do this, could I have it be an oral? And she said she thinks so. I have an appointment with the doctor coming up this week. If I did an oral, if I said okay to do the oral, is that a little safer to do the oral one than
really.
The IV one?
No, it's actually less safe. Mm-hmm. If I give you a pill, that pill is going to go down into your stomach. You have to absorb it, get it through your liver, into your bloodstream. And if I need a little more, I just have to give it another pill and wait another half hour. Mm. If I have giving you more than I want you to have. There's no way to get it out of you.
Right.
With the IV, we start just a small catheter in a vein, and we can squirt in just a little bit. You put in half a cc or a tenth of a cc, and you see the result. And if the lady is still anxious or nervous, and you strike me as somewhat anxious and nervous about the procedure, my dear, they're going to give you a little bit more until you relax.
Yeah.
Once you relax, that's the perfect amount. And these are short-acting things. They wear off very quickly. And as I said, they have reversal drugs available. If for any reason they needed to reverse it, they just squirt a little bit in that IV and you wake right up.
Yeah. It's safe to have that IV line when you're going under for anything.
Yeah, that's for your safety.
Yeah.
Maybe just don't look at it when they put in.
Well, it's more the feel of it, too. Like, I'm okay getting a blood test in my arm because I really am fine with it because I just, it's hurting for those few seconds or minutes, and it's fine. But an IV stays in there the whole time, and you're feeling this in there.
Well, but even there, they can do a little local anesthetic where they put the IV in.
That's right.
Then you won't feel it.
Yeah, we can numb the insertion site so that you have no sensation at all where the IV is in.
Yeah, let your doctor
ask
them.
Yeah, tell him about your concerns. Okay.
And so if I ended up though that I do and I probably I'm really going to consider what you're saying and maybe change my mind. I was pretty sure I was going to ask for the oral, but if I ended up still getting the oral one at all, and they had to reverse that, then they'd have to inject me with the reversal agent, right?
Yes, but they'd have to in order for it to work quickly, they have to get it in a vein. So then they got to try and start an IV while you're having a problem.
Or can't they just inject it?
But then you've got a much slower absorption time.
Oh, okay.
You inject it under the skin or into a muscle is much, much slower than putting it straight into your blood vein.
Yeah, it's always better to be prepared for an emergency rather than to do things in an emergency.
Yes.
Okay, but as far as just the safety of it, why, though, it says, like all the stuff I read kept saying there's contraindications to taking sedatives, even for sleep apnea and if you have breathing issues. And I know I'm not out completely sleeping. I know it's conscious, but I...
Well, because the drugs the drugs depress the brain. And so in sleep apnea, as it is, you're not getting enough oxygen in. And now the drugs are desensitizing the brain, so it's not getting the carbon dioxide load.
And where
it's
people
not sensing it.
Where people get in trouble is when they're taking these drugs and then going to bed.
Yeah.
In other words, you're taking it orally. It's the oral use that gets people into trouble. With your doctor doing it for sedation, you're going to be copacetics with it.
Yes. You're going to be good, Lisa.
Okay, the music says we got to take a break, so you can hang on if you want. We'll be back, but really and truly, I think you just need to relax and go with the flow because it's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for the call, Lisa. We have Joan on the line next. We'll talk to her. And if you have a question for the doctors, here's the number, 206-421-5757. We'll be back. Medicine. Good morning. Lynette here, Dr. Samira Umat and Dr. Jerry Mixon taking your phone calls. A lot of different topics today on Leading Edge Medicine. Here's the number for you to get through. We have room on the phone for you at 206-421-5757. Let's head to Black Diamond. We have Joan on the line. Hi, Joan.
Hello, Joan.
Well, hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. How can we help you, young lady?
Okay. I have a question regarding my son, who's a 42-year-old fellow who has been diagnosed with a parathyroid tumor. He had a normal sonogram with no nodules except this 2.3 centimeter tumor on the parathyroid. His blood PTH is 90, and his calcium is 10. 6.5. The doctor had been watching him for a couple of years because he has low vitamin D and cannot assimilate it.
Okay.
So my question is, they've scheduled a nuclear scan, and I wanted to know if this was the right direction and what the future looked like, or the long-term effects of removing the, hopefully it's only the part of the parathyroid. We don't know.
Yeah, well, okay, there are four parathyroid glands, okay,
right.
two above and two below the thyroid itself. Para means around. And these are involved in calcium and bone metabolism, serum calcium levels and so on. And so parathyroid tumors, you know, can simply disrupt this regulatory system, and you can end up with too much or too little in the way of calcium circulating.
Right, and the parathyroid adenoma is the most common tumor, and it is a benign tumor.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, you only lose one of your four parathyroid glands.
Well, it enlarges. It affects only one. And so when they go in to do the surgery, they'll either try to remove all of it if it's affected or part of it. But then you still have the other three glands that will perform parathyroid function,
right,
which is calcium regulation.
So most people who have a parathyroid tumor that just lose that one of the four really have no bad effects long term.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Yeah. All right. So the next step would be after the nuclear scan to isolate it and then take it out, correct?
Yes.
That's right. That's all it takes.
Okay.
And it's not a terribly complex or difficult surgery. It is a fairly common one in, you know, throat surgeries. There are doctors that specialize in this sort of thing, and they've just got it right down pat. So should not be much of a worry.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome, ma'am.
You're welcome, yeah. Those adenomas can secrete a lot of calcium, and so when you have hypercalcemia, you can cause cardiac rhythm disturbances.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's important to get rid of that.
Yep. So, all right.
They're not life-threatening, and they won't, you know, affect his life expectancy or anything like that.
No, they will not.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'd go on to the next call, but Lynette's not here.
Yeah, well, we can talk about something else.
Yes, or Mr. Engineer, can you give us another call? Nope. Okay, I don't hear a thing. Oh, Louise from Linwood. Okay, go ahead. Louise from Linwood, how are you today?
Good, I'm good. I spoke with you guys about 18 months ago, and my husband... he's in his 50s, and when he orgasms, nothing comes out.
Okay.
Nothing comes out. he's getting ED at this point and that kind of thing. But at the time, you had said you were worried about when that happens that it can affect your heart or other vessels in your body.
With ED, maybe.
Yeah, ED might be, yeah. Let's back up a little bit. Has he had any prostate surgery?
No.
Okay. Okay, that's the most common cause for retrograde ejaculation is prostate surgery. All that is usually happening is the valve that keeps the ejaculate, the semen, from going back up into the bladder. If that valve has gone bad, instead of the semen coming out the penis where you would see it, it flows backwards up into the bladder. And it often can irritate the bladder a bit, and then he gets a real urge to urinate after sex. Not dangerous, does nothing really bad to or for anybody. The connection between erectile dysfunction and the heart is, on the other hand, a very real one. Hang on a second. Okay. Are there any other medicines your husband on? Is he on a narcotic, or has he had chemotherapy for anything?
He's diabetic, and so he takes things for diabetes, and I believe he's got high blood pressure as well.
All right. Yeah. That's very, very common with this, these issues. And erectile dysfunction becomes very common. Diabetics have a high risk of heart disease and they have a high risk of ED. And the two are related in that the most common cause of erectile dysfunction is poor blood supply to the genitals. And if you've got poor blood supply to one part of your body, you often have poor blood supply to many parts of your body because it's all one arterial venous tree. And so if your blood vessels are going bad, you know, then you're not getting good blood flow, and that's why the erections kind of fade away. And so in the bad old days, back when I was an intern and a resident, we used to look at men who developed erectile dysfunction as very high risk of having a heart attack or a stroke in the near future, because that was 50 years ago, and our diagnostic acumen was not quite as good as it is today. Today, we have much better imaging. We have much better medications, a lot of stuff we can do that, you know, 50 years ago when I was a lad in medicine, they had not yet been developed. But it is diagnostic. If a man in his 50s, especially if he's overweight, if he's getting an enlarged abdomen, and he's developing erectile dysfunction, this is somebody we should be looking at very closely to make sure that their cholesterol levels are kept in check and that they have good cardiac function. You know, I'd send him in for a cardiac calcium score, and even have a cardiologist do a treadmill study on him just to make sure that he's not developing angina or other cardiovascular problems. As for the ED, we've got some great medications for that now.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is the drugs we use for ED also improve blood flow to the brain and to the heart.
Right.
So they don't just work on the genitals. They work everywhere in the body. So, you
okay,
know,
the medication, so you're not talking about Viagra. You're talking about something else?
Well, Viagra is one of them. Viagra is not my favorite because Viagra is very short-acting. It has a half-life of about 3 hours or so. So you take Viagra, it takes about 30 minutes to work, and then you've only got 3 or 4 hours to have intercourse, and then it's pretty well worn off, and your blood supply is dwindled back down. I usually prefer to put these men on Tadalafil. It's sold under the brand name Cialis. 5 milligrams every day. And that way, Cialis works for about 36 hours. And if they take a small dose every day, it takes 3 or 4 days to build up their blood supply so they get the best reaction for intercourse. But it's also now built up so that the blood supply to their brain and their heart and their muscles and their kidneys has improved too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my favorite drug for this purpose.
But, you know, there is another thing here, and it's with diabetic men. We do know that they deplete their testosterone and their hormonal milieu very quickly.
Oh, yes.
And so if you're looking for overall health and wellness, yes, sexuality is a big part of it. Hormone replacement therapy will just enhance everything that he does for his diabetes as well as for his own medical problems. So retrograde ejaculation, azoospermia, erectile dysfunction, these are common in diabetics. So what you're saying is nothing to be worried about. Yes, you want to do something about it, but know that his diabetes can cause that. Controlling his diabetes and using the right medications can help with those symptoms. But then at the end of that, hormone replacement therapy like testosterone might actually enhance a lot of other things for him as well. Self-confidence, muscle mass, bone health, cardiac health, that all comes with a proper balancing of hormones.
And as older diabetic men lose their anabolic hormone load, their testosterone, DHEA, depression becomes a big problem, very, very common. They don't tolerate stress, they don't tolerate anxiety, and fatigue and depression just become part of their everyday life. And once more, that's all fixable.
Okay. And would the, you mentioned.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah. You stay on the line. You know what?
Yeah, music says we got to take a break, but
we'll be
right back.
And we'll finish up with you, Louise. Thank you for calling. Stay right there. Leading Edge Medicine will continue in a moment.
Crazy. I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Here we go.
I'm crazy.
He's going to be back on May.
Crazy for feeling so
good. And we're back. Leading Edge Medicine will continue with you this morning. I'm Lynette, here with Dr. Mixon and Dr. Umat, talking behind the scenes. Getting ready for our next, we're going to finish up with Louise here.
Okay.
Yeah, Louise, we were just getting into, talking about the heart, and we're going to finish up our conversation with you.
Okay, so where did we leave it? Louise, what else can we help you with?
Well, I was just wondering if someone with his symptoms would be a really good candidate for the test that you're running on May 9th, or
he would be an excellent candidate for that test because he is high risk by definition. He has lots of symptoms that tell us that the chances of his cardiovascular tree being a danger to his life are significant. He'd also be a wonderful patient to be at Longevity Medical Clinic because we'd help him lose fat, make muscle, improve his cardiac function, probably get his erectile function fixed, and just make him a happier, more robust, energetic man.
We're not doing the InBody during this fair just because of time. We just don't have the, and we have only one InBody machine per clinic, so we're not going to be able to do it. And so only the people who do their longevity labs will get the InBody, and that too at a second visit. We are not able to offer it.
Elizabeth was just bugging me about buying a second machine for her this week.
Well, of course she was bugging you about it because they are held up, right? When the patients come for their blood draw, they are held up because of that machine is being used.
I'll put it on my list.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah, this heart test has been quite popular. You definitely should call in and get an appointment. They will fit you in. If they can't do it Thursday, maybe Wednesday.
And the reason I mentioned the InBody particularly is because we know that diabetic patients lose muscle mass.
Yep.
And we want to measure it. And we won't be able to do it for him this visit.
Yeah. But he should seriously consider doing the full panel, not just the cardiac test, but do the whole longevity panel. Because that'll let us look at 8 different hormones. It'll look at his inflammatory markers. It'll look at his homocysteine, all sorts of things that tell us about his risk of heart attacks and strokes and so on. So,
and remember in the past we always said that diabetes is not reversible. Once you have it for life. And we were the first clinic when we started talking about reversal of prediabetes and diabetes.
We've been reversing type 2 diabetes for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of ex-diabetics in our practice. People who are no longer diabetic.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Thank you so much for all of the information and I'll call for an appointment.
Okay. Good luck to you, okay?
Take care.
Wonderful. We wish him all the best.
Yes.
It's nice to see she's concerned about her husband and is calling on his behalf. And he's in his 50s, right?
Yeah.
So he's very young. He has a whole life ahead of him.
Another 30, 40 years at least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, 80% of the healthcare decisions in America are made by women.
Yeah.
Not by the men. Mm-hmm. The women make decisions for us. They tell us when to go see the doctor.
Yeah, you need to go in. I made you an appointment. I'll drive you there now.
And sometimes people don't know the impact the hormones make on their lives until they start a program like ours. Yep. And that's why they stay with us. I mean, our patients who have reversed their diabetes, they won't leave us. They'll stay with us.
Well, they don't want to get it back.
That's right. Absolutely. All right, we're going to continue talking about the heart. We have Dan calling in from Bellevue. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Good morning. I think I have a Dr. Umat question, if I may.
Sure.
Feel free.
I love to listen to the radio show. It's very informative. and I appreciate it. And I try to listen to the podcast if I can't make it that day. But Dr. Umat, you've referred mm-hmm. to the heart test. The mm-hmm. There's a specific test that does the chemicals and molecules that detect plaque that may rupture. And I was wondering specific which one of those tests that is, and maybe you could elaborate on the chemicals, molecules that you're referring to on that. I'm just curious.
Sure. So the Cleveland Heart Lab, Cleveland calls itself the Center for Excellence for Detecting Heart Disease. And the inflammatory part of this is what we're referring to about the heart rupture risk. So it's myeloperoxidase and LPPLA2. These are two enzyme fractions that are released into the blood vessel when the plaque in the blood vessel is about to rupture. And when they pick that up, they know that when the activities increase, we know that that risk is much higher, and we have to be more aggressive in lowering that LDL fraction. And in those cases, sometimes I also find that the oxidized LDL is really very high, and that's the damaged LDL. And at that time, you know, something like a calcium score is not as useful, because you know that the calcium score looks only at the calcified old plaque. And this is looking at plaque modification on an ongoing basis at the time. And that's why we want to pick it up. Those are the two for the plaque as it is about to rupture specifically. Now, the apolipoproteins, they are about congestion, and they're about carrier molecules and what's happening in the liver. And the lipoprotein particle little A, that is specifically a genetic trait, a genetic risk factor. So if you have that, then that means your risk for heart disease is much higher than the average person who has a normal lipoprotein particle little A. And we know that that runs in family. So when I see that high in a patient, I tell them to go ahead and get their family members, brothers, sons, other members of their family all checked.
So that's great information. I've never actually heard those two referred to, so that's great. But which specific test picks those up of the all the tests you draw within the panel?
So the Cleveland panel will pick up all the ones that I mentioned are part and parcel of the Cleveland panel. With specific regards to the rupture risk, that is with the myeloperoxidase and PLA2.
So there's actually a test that
number. There's a value, there's a number. They will tell you what that actual number is, and whether you're in the normal range, whether you're higher than goal but not at high risk, or whether you're in the red and at high risk. So they give you a whole spectrum of that value.
If I came in to the clinic just for clarification and wanted those specific markers but not the other ones, I mean, just...
Oh, you're saying, can we do them independently of the whole panel? I see. That's a question. Yeah, and that's a great question. I'll actually have to ask Cleveland if they will run just those.
Yeah, we normally just run it as part of our routine panel.
We've never run it separately, so I don't know the answer. I'd have to ask them.
Yeah. Because generally, when we're evaluating somebody, we want to know as much about their their risk as possible. So we want to look at all of the aspects of their lipid profile.
Right. They do subtractions, Jerry, so that might just be a question for them to see if they'll do it and how much it'll cost.
For sure, I'd want to do the whole panel for those reasons. I was just curious, like, to nail down. But that's fine. That's okay. I was just curious. And then when you said when you see those markers, you try to narrow down a subfraction of the LDL. Which subfraction are you referring to?
Right. So when the fractionation study tells us about the LDL particles and the LDL particle number and the LDL particle size. And all three of those are very important. If there are tons and tons of LDL particles and their size is really small, that means that that patient is at a high risk. If they have average number of LDL particles and the average size of that particle is nice and big, then that patient is not at risk like the other ones that I mentioned earlier. So the value may be the same. The LDL value may be 150. But two different scenarios. That LDL value for somebody at 150 may give them large size LDL particles with not a lot of LDL particles themselves. They're not as risk. At much as risk as somebody that has tons of LDL particles and they're all tiny and small.
Okay, may I hang on to ask about LPA?
Sure. Sure, yes. Okay, and then thanks. Sharon, we'll be back with you in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. This is Leading Edge Medicine. We'll be right back.
Touching hands.
Yeah, that's huge.
Reaching out. Touching me. Touching you. Sweet
girl. All together. Bum, bum, bum. We have so much fun on this show. Can you tell? It's Leading Edge Medicine. We're here every Saturday morning live in the studio. I'm Lynette with Dr. Mixon and Dr.
Umat. You know what I just realized?
What?
In my long life, I have never dated a Caroline.
Oh.
I'm not even going there.
I've never dated a Neil Diamond, but, you know.
I just realized that. Caroline. No. Not
if it was Jason
nowhere,
Momoa.
Nowhere in that long, long litany. Names
right.
I can't even remember.
Let's go
there
back to Dan.
Let's get back to Dan's heart
hey,
question.
Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Bring us back down,
hello.
Dan.
Right.
All right. I know you guys like to have a lot of fun. So, yeah, that's so interesting on those molecules. I appreciate that. And then I know you've said the LPA little a is genetic marker. Are either of you aware of any way of decreasing that marker?
That's a toughie.
It is.
And the best way to do it is actually to keep the LDL, total LDL, as low as possible.
Yeah, you're talking about driving that total LDL down into the 50s and 60s.
And lower.
Below
possibly.
70 if you can, yeah.
But that's a tough one.
Well, if the LDL got down to 50 to 70 range, it's possible the LP little a might decrease too.
It seems to be, yeah. It's, you know, it's genetically coded to have the propensity for elevation. So it's really hard to drive it down. But it can be done. I've seen it happen. So.
Cool. All right. Well, you guys are great. I appreciate it. I'll let someone else call.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the call, sir.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Very good. And time for one last caller. Sharon from Renton is on the line. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Good morning. I'm just wondering what you think about PRP for the face, and if you could tell us a little about it.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Umat, you know
wanna,
all about
you
this.
You want to tackle this, or should I?
Vampire facelift.
Vampire facelift.
Yes. Because
the facial, yeah.
I was going to ask you this, too, because you're probably talking about the latest things in the news, talking about some issues that people have had, and we've been doing it here for a long time.
Oh, long time.
Yeah. Let's talk about PRP, because we've all done it, right?
Yeah. Well, PRP.
We have all done it. Well, right? Yes. Oh, okay.
PRP it stands for platelet-rich plasma.
Rich plasma, yes.
And what we do is we draw a sample of blood, we spin it down, we isolate the white and red cells, we throw those away, and then we take the serum, which now still has the platelets in it, and we spin it again at super high speed. I mean, hundreds of gravities. Packing those platelets down into the bottom of the serum.
Yeah.
We draw off the top half of the serum and throw that away. And now what we've got left is plasma that is enriched with platelets. Now, those platelets contain 9 different growth factors to help tissue to grow. And the purpose of the platelets are that if you bump yourself and you break a little blood vessel, that the platelets rush to that spot, they form a little clot to block the blood flow, and then they rupture and release the growth factors and heal that broken blood vessel very quickly, so that just in a matter of days, you've had total repair of that blood vessel, which is really kind of neat. So what they've discovered is that if you take those platelets and you put them in places where you're losing tissue, they trigger the tissue to start growing again. And so if you've, let's say you're a person in their 50s or 60s and your face is starting to melt, you know, you're losing volume up on your cheeks and you're starting to see those deep lines because the things are starting to sag, you can inject the platelet-rich plasma in here and trigger those subcutaneous tissues to start growing again. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing like a fat transfer, like you could take a, suck a little fat off your tummy or your thigh, and you inject that fat along with the platelet-rich plasma, then about half of the fat will survive and grow and fill in with your natural filler instead of having to inject artificial fillers in. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, we can also use the PRP just on its own without mm-hmm. any fat transfer, just PRP yep. alone as a filler. We just have to treat it a little bit differently yep. if that's the purpose of it.
Well, it takes several times, too.
Yeah.
It's, if they put a commercial filler in,
yeah.
you put it in, it's there from day one.
Yes.
But your body will absorb it over time. And so depending on which filler it is, anywhere from 6 months right. to 6 years, it'll fade away and need to be replaced. The PRP is your own natural tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it, if you get PRP filler put in every few months,
yeah.
after 3 or 4 injections, you find that you're actually developing more and more of your own tissue and you need less and less filler.
Right. And then the other ways are, you know, as Dr. Mixon was mentioning, we can use it as part and parcel of a facial with microdermabrasions, microneedlings. And when you're doing that, they just put the PRP on the face itself and it's absorbed into the skin and it helps with healing and growth factors. So it basically becomes more natural and it allows more collagen and more tissue to grow. And then the final way that we use it in our clinic is with radiofrequency. So we use it with the laser machines with our Potenza, and we actually make holes in the skin with the laser machine, and then the PRP is played later right on top of that. And what that allows is the suction of the machine itself allows deeper penetration of the PRP into the skin. And that then gives you the collagen growth factor. So it helps grow collagen. So there are many ways that you can use PRP on the face for a cosmetic benefit. It just depends upon what your preference is and what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any downsides to the PRP on the face?
You know, this is your own plasma. Obviously, we can never say there won't be any infection or anything like that. We have not had any on our hands in our clinics. We're very, very careful about how we do the procedure. If there's an open wound or there's a acne lesions or something, we try to avoid that area so we don't spread any infection. But most people usually do great. We've not had any problems. They usually feel much better. They like the look. They like the tightening that it causes on the skin.
Yeah. The only downside is that it is much slower as a filler than
the filler.
The
it definitely yeah, is. Yeah,
you know, as compared to the commercial fillers, because
if you're using it for a filler, but many people do use it for microneedling yeah, or radiofrequency microneedling
to give thicker, more yeah. elastic skin.
Yeah, that's more common than it being used as a filler.
Mm-hmm. And I also, if you're trying to get more elastic, prettier skin. I also like to have progesterone cream.
Well, yes, and we sell that you put commercial on creams as well. Because, you know, what I tell people is that when you do a procedure and you're using a laser treatment, what you're doing is investing in yourself. And it costs a lot of money. And when you're doing that, if you use a good commercial cream or whatever else you're using, it then enhances the results of what you're doing. It makes it last a little bit longer. So that could be a TNS essential serum or it could be hyaluronic acid. We can make recommendations based on what your skin tone is like and what your needs are. But definitely, and our hormone replacement therapy, there's absolutely no doubt that hormone replacement therapy use of estrogen and progesterone transdermally makes a huge difference to skin tone and skin texture as we're aging.
All right. Sharon, is that helpful for you?
Yes, that's very good information. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, my dear.
You're welcome.
Very good.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you for calling.
Absolutely. And, of course, we do those at Bella Medica, which is part of the Longevity Medical Clinics, correct?
That's right. Indeed,
yeah,
it is.
You can go to the Bella Medica website and get details on the PRP microneedling.
That's right. The master aestheticians will provide those services, and they do consult. Consultations are all free. And then you do want more than one treatment, and so they will tell you how many they think you should get. And we periodically will run promotions. So, you know, call and find out what's going on.
Very good. All right. Well, that's it for our show today. Do want to remind you that if you'd like to get in on our Heart Health Day this Thursday and maybe some appointments Wednesday, then you need to call for that appointment. We've been talking a lot about the heart today. May is Heart Health Month, which is why we've chosen May the 9th to do our heart testing. And you can find out more about that and make your appointment at 866-86-YOUNG. That's 866-86-YOUNG. All right. Well, that's the show for today. We'll be back live in the studio next Saturday morning right here on this station. Hope you'll join us. Get your questions ready. And if you didn't get through today, try us a little earlier next week and we'll get you on. I'm Lynette on behalf of Dr. Samira Umat and Dr. Jerry Mixon. Have a wonderful rest of your day. May the 4th be with you. And we'll be back next weekend.